Economics is the study of human choice in the world we live. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. By investigating faith in economics, we can learn how they lead to human flourishing. This is the Faith in Economics Podcast, a presentation of the Gortney Institute at Ottawa University.
Welcome to our show today. I am Kevin Ugarteche, producer and graduate assistant for the Gortney Institute. Dr. Ross McCullough, the founder of the Gortney Institute and Wayne Angel Chair of Economics. Dr. Justin Clark, the Menard Family Professor of Philosophy and Ethics. And finally, Dr. Peter Jacobson, the Gortney Professor of Economic Education and Research.
All right. So, COVID kind of changed the way we think about the hours we work, maybe how we work with remote work and all kinds of things. And Dr. Jacobson here has kind of been writing on a few topics of people thinking, can we work less hours and still maintain a standard of living? You know, what does it mean with the standard of living and how does that connect with work hours? So, Peter, what do you got to say?
Yeah, so all this stems from a few weeks ago, I saw a lot of headlines that Bernie Sanders, our favorite senator, was proposing that we would pass a bill that would give everyone a four-day work week. And the headline thing that kind of drove me crazy was it would be a four-day work week for the same pay. And you might be wondering, how could the journalists know that we'd be paid the same for this four-day work week? And the answer is, well, that's what Bernie Sanders put in his bill, is that the law says that we would be paid the same for this four-day work week. And so I wrote an article addressing this. If we want to talk about the specifics of that, we can. I don't mind talking about why. By the way, the answer is that won't happen, at least not without overthrowing our entire economic system, in which case it won't happen eventually anyways. But it's not possible. But that led to a follow-up question I received in the form of an email. Someone wanting to know about this argument that is apparently made by a lot of socialists, which I hadn't heard this one in particular before. I've heard similar ones, but this one in particular, that for most of human history, the argument goes, people worked about 15 hours a week. And so we ourselves could also work 15 hours a week. And the only reason we work more is because artificial scarcity created by capitalism or something like this, right? one of those like Marxian phrases. And so I think we should talk a little bit about, and Russ, you can give your impressions too. I don't want this to be a whole like Peter reads his own article thing or anything like that. But I think we should talk about whether or not it is possible to work a lot less and maintain the standard of living. That's one thing that we should talk about. And also whether or not, even if we can't maintain the same standard of living, it might be worthwhile to think about working less. So that's kind of our two different topics. It gets into a lot of cultural stuff right now. People are talking about like work-life balance a lot lately in the West and, not having a grinding mindset. That's one of the like popular memes among kids on TikTok is like, you shouldn't be the person who grinds at your job. You should be the person who does the minimum requirements and then goes home.
Yeah.
So I think we could talk about all of that in one podcast here.
Well, I'll lead off a little bit with my COVID comment is that I thought what happened there was that the standard of living was kind of forcefully reduced, right? Like nobody could go out to eat as much as they did before. And maybe the activity levels were down. They couldn't go out to the movies. They couldn't do something else. And so if people lowered their standard of living and they found, I'm still can find happiness at this level. Well, that might mean that you could then work a little less. Maybe one spouse doesn't have to work or works part time. And so that's what I meant by my COVID comment, that it's if standard of living was chosen to be lower because of maybe what some people learned through COVID, then that has a chance. But otherwise, yeah, I don't see that's a mystery to me on how standard of living, when we think about what does that mean in terms of dollars out the door, in many cases. Some things are free though, right? So it's kind of your standard of living. What brings you joy? What brings you happiness? Is there a price tag associated with it or not? Is going to be related to your work.
One of the difficulties with this claim is to get across to people because people don't naturally understand that employers do not set wages. Like this is the first step in the process of understanding what's going on here. And here's the little thought experiment to prove to yourself that employers don't set wages. If you are an employer and you wanted to set a wage that would, and let's say you're really greedy, like we assume most employers are, you wanted to set a wage that would bring you the most money possible, what would that wage be? Maybe we could be like the legislators in Washington, D.C. and set a zero wage and have all these interns, right, come work for our company. In fact, maybe a negative wage. Maybe people come and pay you for the privilege of working at your company, right? So why don't employers do this? Like, that seems like the best thing for an employer to do is just not pay their workers at all. You could say the law, but that's not the only reason. Before there were minimum wage laws. In fact, internships skirt minimum wage laws. But even if, before there were minimum wage laws, people still paid people money. What this highlights is there's competition in the labor market, right? There's more than one place that's willing to hire a person.
In today's day and age in the classroom, I find this real easy to tell students because it's like, what's the federal minimum wage? $7.25. Why aren't employers paying it? That
Right.
answers the question, right? I mean, they all know now that they can go get a job, a low, no skill job at McDonald's or Walmart or whatever, and they're all paying like $11, $12 an hour. Well, that doesn't sound like the profitable thing to do, right?
Yeah.
If the government allows you to only pay $7.25, so.
Yeah. So here's how we can break it down. As long as there's a competitive labor market, which sometimes people have an argument about this, but I don't know any real monopsonies in the world. But let's throw that all aside for a second. If you've got two fast food joints in town, Justin wants a job at a fast food joint. Let's say Justin produces $15 an hour worth of products, and you've got these two companies who are bidding for him. Well, one might offer to pay him 10 and they'd make $5 an hour off his labor. But then the second one could say, hey, if we decide to pay Justin 11, then we can still make $4 an hour of profit, pure profit off his labor. And this bidding war continues until basically each fast food restaurant is willing to pay Justin up to $15 an hour, pretty close to it, if not exactly $15 an hour, to get him as an employee in their shop. And so we've got people being paid basically the value they're producing in competitive labor markets. So then let's imagine that, Bernie Sanders comes and passes a law and says, well, I want you to pay Justin for a full 40 hours, but only have him work 32 hours, and you have to pay him the same amounts. Well, by definition, if that restaurant was already paying Justin pretty close to the value he produced for them, then all of a sudden 8 hours of Justin's work are gone that the restaurant still has to pay for Justin. In that case, the best thing to do is fire Justin, right? Like every week you're losing 8 hours worth of money on Justin, 15 times eight, whatever that comes out to, 120, I think. They're losing 120 by keeping Justin on every week. And so they fire him. So what could Justin do then? Well, he could go apply for a job at the other fast food restaurant. And what are they going to pay him? Well, they're going to pay him now what it's worth to pay him for 4 days of the week that he's going to work now instead of five. And so by this process of being fired and rehired, that wage is going to change. Now, at this point, a Bernie person could say, well, let's just force the new restaurant to pay what the old restaurant
Or
paid.
ban firing.
Yeah, or ban
Which, by the
firing.
way, India did on different governments have done it. Like, oh, let's end unemployment. Let's ban firing. And
Yeah, so
that could
there's
be
like a
amendment number one to Bernie's
We could
lawsuit.
keep going, and we get into this really interesting territory of, okay, if we ban firing, what happens? Well, if this happens on all industries, every company starts losing money like every week, right? And so there's two possibilities then. Companies all shut down, which would be bad because then Justin would make $0. So Bernie Sanders, I promise you're going to get the same pay, still doesn't work. Or the government could come in and start putting money into companies to make sure they don't shut down. But notice where we're at if that's true. The government is putting in the capital for the company. It's making wage and hiring decisions for the company. At that point, you have a government-owned company. Like there's no sense in which that company is really like legitimately privately owned anymore. And so we've moved from a capitalist system to a socialist system over the series of steps here. Now, I'm not saying that will happen if Bernie's bill passed. I think likely what would actually happen is it would stop at the firing part. Like people would get fired and rehired for less wages. And, Bernie would be like, I don't understand what happens. They're legally not allowed to. So I think that's what actually would happen. But the point is, this gets to one of Ludwig von Mises's ideas about the dynamics of interventionism, that when you interfere with a market economy, if you want to succeed at that interference, you have to take over successively larger parts of the market economy to make up for the distortions that your policies have caused. And so the policy cannot stand on its own. It has to eat up increasing parts of the economy. And so the point is that Bernie Sanders, his plan won't work, But this brings us to the second interesting question, which is a lot of anthropologists have studied.
Actually, before you go second go part, let me, I wanted to bring up one thing that is kind of hopefully funny, but also maybe related to this, is that Justin would go to work for the burger place for less as long as they had a 50% employee discount off hamburgers.
Sure.
And then the employer would get kind of beef, because if you've ever seen Justin eat a burger, like, he puts down like three or four of them. So there's definitely going to be losing money on this proposition from the employer. And that, so that made me think that some of these other non-wage benefits would start to disappear to compensate, would be another outcome, I think, from having some sort of legislation on that. And again, then maybe they would start to plug holes, like, you can't change your employee benefit plan or something.
Yeah, yeah. You could cut benefits. You could make Justin clean the bathroom on top of all of his other responsibilities, which he doesn't have time for anymore. So he has to skip his lunch break. Like, there's all sorts of ways in which this becomes squared. But the end result is you do not get paid the same amount of money for less work.
Yeah.
Like, there is no world that's compatible with the laws of economics that that happens. Go ahead, Justin.
Or you can get paid the same amount of money for less work, and the money won't be able to buy what it could before.
Yeah. So if the government starts injecting money into businesses by printing it, and then all of a sudden your nominal prices go way up, and so your money can't buy what it used to.
Yeah. And I liked what you brought up, and somebody at our conference we just recently went to was bringing this up too, that, you know, the traditional, if you look up a textbook definition of socialism, it's something about, you know, more government ownership of resources. But in reality, socialism here in the United States can start to take the form of more and more government control, like Peter was saying, is that if there's, you know, oh, we have private ownership, but you have to do it this way, this way, this way, this way. And then the more constraints that are placed on, we're really essentially looking like a government-owned entity with such restrictive rules that you don't have much discretion, actually, in running your own business.
Yeah, it's PINO, right? Private name only.
Yeah.
So, but this does get us to the second point, which is maybe like a response or a redress to this, which involves, I think, just outright denying economics in general to some extent. But the claim is this, it's that, like, we have looked at hunter-gatherer societies, we're talking about pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer societies, so they don't farm. And we found tribes, and one tribe in particular is used as an example a lot. I'm not going to try to pronounce the name because it involves like things like foreign to the English language, so I'll end up getting it wrong. It's a tribe in, I think, Namibia that anthropologists have looked at. And at the early 20th century, the claim is that these folks could work somewhere around like 17 hours a week and provide enough food to subsist, to live, like, plenty of calories. And, you know, they kind of travel around, so they don't like have like permanent housing. They kind of stay in one place, and they're nomadic to a certain degree. And if you go and survey these people, they say they're very happy. So the claim is that, like, the whole system that we've created is basically a lie. We could all, as humans, just live in the state of nature and be happy. You know, life is not nasty, brutish, and short is part of the claim. Like, the life expectancy is, you know, you could live past 60 years. They actually don't give life expectancy number, but they say if you live to age 15, important qualifier, which we can talk to later, your life expectancy is over 60 years, which isn't too bad for working, you know, only a few hours a week. And so I think we should talk about to what extent these people are crazy and to what extent they might have a point. So,
yeah, I have a couple different directions I would like to go with, to what extent they have a point.
Leave us with a couple of cliffhangers.
I think they have two points, and I think that neither of those points is in opposition to what you said about the economics of the issue. And I do think that they are right to some degree about both of these points, but it makes me crazy because I think that when they are right about both of these points, they get the economics so wrong that the policy prescriptions that they make to address these two points usually end up being counterproductive.
Sure.
Okay. Well, yeah, that looks like a great cliffhanger to come back into the second half with. So we will be back in just a bit.
Ottawa University has an exciting new major, PPE, which stands for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. Each of these fields is interesting in their own right, but they intersect in ways that are important to understand, both individually and for your community. If you find philosophy fascinating but want to make sure that your study of the subject is practical, if you enjoy economic analysis but want to see how economic laws interact with moral principles, if you are interested in politics but want to explore how economic and ethical realities constrain our political choices, you should consider the PPE program at Ottawa University.
This spring, Ottawa University is organizing a PPE League competition for politics, philosophy, and economics. Students in this competition will compete leveraging the ideas of philosophy, politics, and economics in various events. If you're a professor or an advisor of college students and you're interested in your school competing in PPE League this spring, contact Peter, Justin, or Russ today.
By 2030, the Gortney Institute will be known for its alumni, supporters, and participants who incorporate economic understanding with their faith in their careers, vocations, communities, and personal lives. We have some great programming going on for high school students. We have an online microeconomics class. Yes, you can earn college credit for $200 by taking an online class. It's affordable, flexible, layered with support. Our new online micro is optimized for you. If you'd like to consider some events for your high school students or that class, please contact Justin, Peter, or Russ today. All right, so we're back, and Justin was teasing us on some points that they get wrong, and then the economics is especially wrong, even though they might have a little bit of truth, which is always dangerous. So I'm anxious to hear what Justin has to say.
So one of the things that I think these arguments usually trade on, and I've heard it, it's interesting that Peter brought up the argument that it was like, 100 years ago or whatever, and then this other tribe that's, worked a lot less than we do. And I've also heard it recently, it's come up a lot recently, like, oh, well, if you look back even 30 years ago, Americans could live on one paycheck and have a car and a single family home and a TV, et cetera. And people were happy. Those are kind of two different claims. One is like people were happy, and the other is look at the material things that they could have.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to separate these things, because the happiness claim is true of people in tribes in Namibia or whatever, right? Or Namibia, I don't know.
Yeah, Guatemala, when we see a lot of happy people.
But psychologically, we know that when you look at the way these things are tested and what the strong results are, is that usually people measure their happiness goes up when they are materially well off relative to the other people around them. Yeah, it's very easy to be like happy in Versailles when you are, a French noble person and you are among the very richest people in France, even though in Versailles there are no toilets and the French nobility were literally, pardon my French here, crapping in stairwells because nobody had plumbing. Were these people happy? Yes, but if you got that same standard of living today relative to other people, that wouldn't make you happy, because you know that other people that there is like a much better way to do things. So that's one thing, is that just measuring happiness and saying like we can all somehow go back, I don't think that you can go back in this sense, because if one of the measurements of happiness is how you are, how well you off are materially relative to those people around you, which really I think means relative to what you think is possible, then the going back thing doesn't really work. And it only works, even if it could possibly work, if everybody went back to a certain degree. And I don't think that would happen. So the other thing that I think there might be some truth to is that it seems like another thing people who make this argument are saying is we're working so much, and a lot of the work that is being done doesn't seem productive. And I think that actually, that is a point, and I think it's a valid one.
Yeah.
If you look at, for instance, all the work, if you go to like a traditional doctor, if you go look at all the work that's done in the healthcare sector, an enormous amount of the actual labor hours between you and your physician at the checkup involves regulatory compliance.
Yeah.
And so there's a book I don't want to only malign anthropologists here. One of the anthropologists that I like reading that I don't agree with a lot is David Graeber, who's dead, but he had this book called Bullshit Jobs. And his claim was that the that the amount of bullshit jobs in the economy has increased. And a bullshit job you defined as one in which like a lot of the work seems to be busy work, and it seems to be work that actually isn't economically productive, even though it does get like counted in GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very sympathetic to the claim that a lot of the work being done is a kind of busy work that isn't actually economically productive, and therefore like doesn't really add to our societal wealth in a way.
Yeah.
And
doesn't pass cost benefit analysis.
Yeah. And the only way that work, I mean, the only way you can do that work is if it's subsidized by actually productive work. And so I think there is a sense in which we could be doing less actual hours and having the same or more amount of growth. The problem from my perspective is the same people who point this out usually say, and the way we should get to eliminating all this, you know, excess work is we need to have Bernie Sanders be in charge of the economy.
Right.
And I go, wait, let's take a look at where all this BS work is coming from. And it seems like to me an inordinate amount of this is regulatory compliance. And so I'm in favor of like, let's let the experiment run. Maybe we could get away with fewer hours of work. One of the reasons everybody works 40 hours a week is because there are laws around the kind of benefits that only get provided by what we call a full-time job. And so that that makes it the case that we need people to, you know, you either work 80 hours or 40 hours a week or, you know, 15 hours a week or something like that. And so I'm in favor of this idea that, oh, well, maybe we can get by with less. And I think Peter was saying this earlier that maybe, you know, people should be more open to seeing if they are happier working a less amount of hours. But it seems to me that the barrier to this is regulatory. It's not something that the Bernie Sanders of the world can fix.
Yeah, so let me hop in and say, I agree with that these folks have maybe identified like a decent problem. The solution is certainly wrong. And so the solution amongst this group of people is like, let's return to subsistence hunting and gathering, which is it's kind of insane to say out loud, but a lot of people do advocate for this.
Yeah.
Which is ironic because a lot of these people are the same people who say that like housing and healthcare and like internet are human rights. And there are not hunter-gatherer societies with like modern housing, electricity, internet, and healthcare.
Yeah.
And so, like the way that we know subsistence like farming is not the way forward. I just ran some simple numbers. And so I looked at this tribe, by the way, the author of the book included on the side that like, oh, they spend something like 7 hours a week fixing their tools, but modern economic calculations don't consider this part of people's work anyways. And that's wrong. The modern economic calculations do consider the fact that people fix tools as part of their work. If you're fixing your own thing, you're doing it on the job. If you're hiring someone else, that's other hours for someone else. And so when you add that in, the tribe actually works closer to like 23, 24 hours a week. In the United States, our total working hours on average are 33 hours per week. We are not at 40. Like that's the usual for a person is 40, but a lot of people work part-time jobs or work less than their full-time job. So we're talking about 10 more hours per week of work in the US. So it's not even that much. That's the start, is to note it, like it's not double. It's not a change from 15 to 40 or something like that. We're talking about 33 and 23. Now, what does that get you? Well, in the US, workers spend about 11% of their wages on food. And so if you take 11% of 33 hours, you're 3 to 4 hours. So in the US, we spend 3 to 4 hours gathering food compared to the 17 hours to 24 hours, depending on who you count, that this tribe spends. And so we actually spend a lot less time gathering food. So what do we do with all this extra time? Well, one thing we have is housing. And so these people made temporary huts. Oftentimes they wouldn't even live in them. They would just put their stuff in them and stay outside and sort of just live outside. So if you enjoy housing, a significant number of hours is contributed to housing. So you might say, well, in order to be subsistence in the United States, you have to have a house and you're not allowed to have a makeshift hut. And this actually speaks sort of to the problem Justin was bringing up that like, yeah, it's true. You can't buy a piece of land and put a tent on it. And there's probably, I do have a problem with that. There's probably something wrong with that. To a certain extent. But even if you include housing, that's only 33% of people's expenditures. And so that's only another 11 hours. So that's 14 hours. That is still less than the tribe to buy housing and food, both when they don't even have housing there in any like a long-term permanent sense.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we get to the other things which are different, and the most important being medicine. So one of the claims in one of these articles that was written in the Atlantic was they lived relatively long lives, especially compared to agricultural societies. And that's true. Compared to agricultural societies, they did tend to have relatively high life expectancies. The life expectancy, again, they didn't put a hard number on, but somewhere around 60, a little more than 60. Now in the US, we're at 84, which sounds a little better, but you know, 60 is still pretty long. But the real kicker is that the life expectancy is only 60 if you make it to 15. The average life expectancy of this tribe is like 34. What that means when you have a big distance between those two numbers is a lot of infants and children die. So the question I can pose to the audience is, would you be willing to work for 10 more hours a week to significantly increase the chance that your children don't die? I don't know about listeners at home. That seems like a really easy calculation to me. And so the solution of going back to subsistence is just a bad solution, because even like the essentials, the necessities like medicine, by definition are above subsistence. Like those are things we discovered because we worked harder than we need to just get by the end of the day. And I think disparaging that sort of work is anti-human, frankly, disparaging the fact that we've done scientific research to, you know, discover amoxicillin. Like it would be foolish of us to say that, like, oh, people were working too hard when they developed antibiotics, or when they developed like widespread hand washing technology so people could not be as sick. So that's my problem with the arguments, my main problem. But I do agree with Justin that a lot of not only the work, but a lot of the expenses that we encounter in our society are due to like regulatory burdens, right? Like, why can't people in most places afford housing? Well, a big reason is like you can't buy land and just put like a single wide trailer on it in most places. You just can't. You have to build a house, right? And we can talk about the different reasons and whether or not, you know, there's any explicit like benefit to that. But it still is the case that a lot of the reason that it's quote unquote so expensive to live here is because we just have all these rules that make it expensive to live here.
Yeah. I wanted to first touch on Justin's comment about subsistence farming that ties back to, I think it was our last podcast or the podcast before, with government regulations. And the reason why we can't, you know, justify doing it as much is because of a lot of the regulations that drive us to have bigger and bigger farms to justify to handle the regulations, which leads us to mass production of food and regulations on food safety, and all of that stuff kind of plays into driving those costs up and some of the busy work or unproductive work that is associated with that. I think is a great comment that we're paying people, but we're not getting a lot of benefit out of it if it's wasteful on some of those areas. And so, you know, you might say, well, at least somebody's safe or something at the margin. Well, with the slowdown or the drag that it puts on economic growth is pretty significant, and it's related to this question with ours. So I dug up my textbook and I found in 1919, to buy a dozen eggs was 80 minutes of time. It's 4 minutes in 2019. Sugar, 72 minutes in 1919, 8 minutes today. 55 minutes to buy some coffee, 11 minutes today. 13 minutes for a loaf of bread, 4 minutes today. So again, across the board, and a lot of this has to do with innovation and, oh, well, things have changed for us. Well, the reason they've changed is because there's incentives to change them.
Yeah.
There's a profit incentive there. And anytime government erects these barriers, that profit incentive minimizes and in some cases disappears. And so we don't have those same incentives. 1956, clothes, a washer and dryer, 256 hours. It's only 23 hours of our time today in 2019. So there's just time and time again, even the calculator back in 1972 was 31 hours and it's 4 minutes now for a cheap calculator.
Now, let me hop in here because this is one of the responses often given by like the supporters of this view that like we work too much is like, yeah, the washer and dryer saves time on washing and drying clothes. But you know what else saves time on not washing and drying clothes? Not feeling like you have to have a bunch of clothes, right? And so this is like one of the claims that is made by the argument is where the term is we're on a hedonic treadmill. I've heard this before, that like, you know, we get more and we enjoy it and that makes us want more. And the people next to Jessica could probably explain that term a little bit better. But the point is A comment is made basically that there's a lot of unnecessary stuff that we get that we wouldn't, it doesn't even make us happy. This is the argument that like, you think clothes make you happy, but they actually don't. You're wrong about what makes you happy. To that argument, I would say that's certainly wrong about medicine, which is why I go back to the life expectancy thing. It's like, I don't care what anybody says. No one's ever going to convince me that I'm want a world where my kids are very likely to die. I will not trade that for like, you know, enjoying my day, only gathering nuts and berries and then coming back home. I want the medicine. And I actually do think there is a point. I actually do agree with the idea that we probably are over material. I think people probably think they value like frivolous material goods more than they actually do. And I think that has something to do with Justin's Versailles comment from earlier. I think it has something to do with that. But I think even like, you know, I see like these places like Temu, which advertised at the Super Bowl and got a lot of controversy, where they're just basically like selling very cheap consumer goods and clothes. And like, there is a part of me that somewhat agrees with like the, they're not anti, well, maybe anti-capitalist types. The part of me that agrees with them is like, yeah, I actually bet we could live without a lot of that. And I do think like there is some sort of like engineering that's happened that we like feel like we need all these trinkets and we'd probably be just as happy without them. But A, I have no interest in enforcing my will on that on other people. Like, you have to not like having an entire wardrobe of clothes. You have to be a minimalist. That sort of thinking drives me insane, that like other people have to also try or experiment of what you could live without. So I don't like that aspect. I lost my second point, but Justin, I think you want to top in.
I have two. The first one's kind of stupid and probably sexist, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Get ready to bleed.
I don't know if you guys have seen the show Trailer Park Boys.
I've seen episodes.
I used to watch that with my dad all the time, and my mom hates the show. And my girlfriend at the time hated the show. My wife hates the show.
Sure.
I think that men like the show and women don't like the show. And I have a theory as to why men like the show and women hate the show.
Men can live like this and be happy.
And yeah. Because in the show, you know, the two protagonists, Ricky and Julian, you know, Ricky lives out of his car. He lives on pepperoni sticks. He just gets drunk all day. And Julian is pretty much the same thing. Yeah, they're a little bit more together. But I think when men watch the show, they think like, you know what? I think I could be happy living in Canada out of my car in a trailer park. And I think that women watch the men that they like watch the show and they go,
don't get ideas.
This show is selling Justin on this idea that what we should do is move to Canada and sell our teeth or whatever. I agree with Peter that I think we could be happy with less. I think I could be happy living in a trailer park in Canada, eating pepperoni. But the second point I had was that not only do we make these predictions going backward, but if you look backward, you can see people making these predictions going forward, saying things like, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, they'd say, if productivity increases this much, we will only have to work 13 hours a week to meet the demands where we have food, transportation, one car per family, maybe, and, you know, TV or whatever. But it turns out that people have worked roughly 40 hours, you know, 35 or whatever from then to now. So I think if we're honest, we would want to say something like, well, why is it the case that no matter how much people tend to get for this amount of work, they don't seem to be dialing back on that work that much? And maybe one answer to that is the regulatory apparatus that we described earlier. But I actually think another answer to that is, and this might be controversial too, I actually think people do like work.
Yeah.
And it's a mistake to think that if you could get everything just by snapping your fingers, that you would therefore just sit around all day. When we did the hobbies show, a lot of people have hobbies that look remarkably like what people used to do for work a long time ago.
Carving.
If people go, like, I have a punching bag in my garage that I'm not training for a fight, right? I'm doing that kind of exercise because I like doing it. It's work and it's hard and it sucks when I'm doing it, but I feel good after. And I like to do it. So I also tend to think that humans are kind of built for work in a way that I think a lot of this analysis tends to ignore.
Yeah, absolutely. So you kind of brought me into some final comments I'd like to make on, since this is the Faith and Economics podcast, that I think we are designed to work by God's design. That was all baked into the plan. And the other thing that was baked in, maybe not the original plan, but happened, was sin. And so I think when we see all these happiness studies where it's relative happiness, what really ultimately creeps in is envy and, coveting or whatever. And so it's our sinful nature that ends up making us not as happy. But if everybody's equally miserable or everybody doesn't have material things, then we, don't see that same thing. So this relative happiness is the thing to try to overcome. And I try to teach that to my students in different ways that just say, get over it. Some people have more stuff than you. Learn to live on lower, and you can be pretty financially successful and not have the stresses that some people do that get wrapped up into these material things and take out loans and don't really have the money to afford them. Get over it, right? But that's easier said than done, because the sin is baked into the world and you, you can't just overcome it very easily.
Yeah. My final comments on this are, I have a friend who recently took opportunity, his work offered him, you can work 4 days instead of five. And we're just going to give you cuts that are commensurate with the less work. So, one fifth of your salary is going to be reduced or whatever. Mm. And he ended up taking the deal. And I don't have any problem with that. So I want to preface with that. Here's how I think about these things in general. Is that I think we should want to do more in life and we should be okay with less. We should want to do more, but we should be okay with less. But the key with we should want to do more, that doesn't mean that you should narrowly want to do more at a job, right? There are several ways that you can work. One of those avenues of work is the job, but one of those avenues of work could be, again, a hobby or a community or something like that. I think that it is wasteful for people to work the minimum and sit at home and do nothing. And I think that's wrong. I don't think people should do that. Obviously you can have some downtime, but what I'm saying is your goal should not be to maximize downtime. I think that is a way to waste a life.
Yeah.
The opposite of that is not just going and grinding at a job, a desk job for 80 hours a week. That's not the opposite. The opposite is doing lots of different things, including work. I think we should want more for ourselves, for our children, for humanity. We should want to make things better. We should want to push above subsistence, but we should also be okay with, when that's not the result, right? We should be able to accept less in terms of these small comforts and things like that. That's my general thought. So the spirit of the argument that humans should be willing to work less, I think is correct. But the sort of underlying spirit that work is bad and we should avoid doing things and really we should just be these people who dance and eat food, I think that in itself is harmful and it's the wrong direction to go.
Yeah, we're called to a higher purpose. The other thing with the capitalism and that mentality and being anti-capitalist is that we have people in the mix. So yeah, that probably is true that some not so good outcomes come from a market system and too much, let's say, materialism, consumerism is pushed in some way, shape, or form. And it might be because the business owner really doesn't have the heart. The sin is there to care about the people. For that particular person, it's more about the greed and the profit at the end of the day. So things will look a lot different in heaven. So we'll maybe end it on that unless somebody else has final word. All right, this has been a production of the Gortney Institute here at Ottawa University. I'd like to thank you all for listening. 5-star rating helps other people find us. Please pass this along to your friends and family through other media as you see fit. Other than that, be fruitful and multiply. Thanks.